Okay, thank you for attending today. This is the 2020 Sunstone Digital Symposium, session 336, titled Stronger Together: How to Communicate Through Differences of Faith and Belief. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. The video recording of the session will be available in the Whova app for the remainder of 2020. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, "There is more than one way to Mormon." We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. About today's session. This session provides some examples in how to maintain relationships and communicate with people who don't share your same faith or belief. Take a second to introduce you to our speakers. First is Riley Osland. He's a Gen Z banker living in Harriman, Utah, with his wife and three dogs. He is pursuing an undergraduate degree in finance by working as an analyst for Goldman Sachs. Riley has been a part of numerous book clubs and support groups that provide a safe place for Mormons of all levels of belief to reconcile difficult issues in Mormonism with their own belief system and thoughtfully deconstruct and reconstruct their faith. Angelica Lloyd is a lover of all good things and has a passion for helping people. She received a degree in history from BYU, Idaho. While preparing for an MPH program, she volunteers as a peer support specialist and crisis line counselor. She has run her own handmade clothing business for 8 years while staying home with her three children. Outside of alternate LDS faith journeys and mental health, she loves sewing, collecting vintage and antique sewing machines, reading, and best of all, sitting deep in thought, preferably in a hot bath, and writing. Nicholas R. Stewart is originally from California and now resides in Baltimore, Maryland, where he works as a transit planner. He is no longer an active believing member of the LDS Church, though he is active in transitioning ex and post-Mormon social media groups. Nicholas is a fan of forums like Sunstone, where people can share their stories and experiences. I'll now give the floor over to first of our presenters, Riley.
All right, give me just a second to get myself all set up here, share my screen. And I think you guys can see me now too. Give me just one moment to situate something here. Okay, well, thank you. Thanks for allowing me to be with you all today. I'm honored to be in great company. And I'd like to just start by setting one expectation for the few thoughts I'll share today. While my Mormon experiences have been primarily related to the mainstream Utah Latter-day Saint Church, I recognize that there's a wide and diverse selection of Mormon experiences here at Sunstone that tie back to numerous faith traditions and belief. I hope that as I share examples or experiences from my naturally limited Mormon lens of Mormonism, that each of you may use these stories in ways that relate back. I want to start by talking about a video I recently saw on the new social media platform, TikTok. The video showed the two predominant methods for tying shoes and was arguing about which one was better. So the first method is one where you take one loop and then you wrap the other lace around it and pull it through the hole and then pull both laces tight. And the second method is the bunny ear method that I think many of us are aware of, where you take both laces and make loops, you cross the loops, you take one loop and pull it through the hole that was formed by crossing the loops, and then pull the loops tight. There were thousands of comments on this video debating as to which method was better. So let's kind of come back to the shoes and the shoe tying moment. Day by day, as each of us engage in authoring our own book called Life, we have experiences unique to us that influence the path that our lives take. Our lived experiences influence our thoughts, our actions, our beliefs, and each of us and each of our lived experiences are unique to us. Some experiences in my life that I recognize as impactful, to who I am and my worldview today would be things like the day that I was married, the passing of certain loved ones, when my older brother was elected student body president of Brigham Young University, or the time when a close friend trusted my wife and I in telling us that he was gay. Many of us here today have deeply impactful lived experiences that directly relate to Mormonism. For me, experiences like my first reading of the Book of Mormon, my first time through an LDS temple, or my Mormon faith crisis come to mind. Although there are various methods for tying our shoes, when we think of some of the most lasting and impactful lived experiences we've had, most of us probably don't think of the day that we learned to tie our shoes. And if for some reason that day was deeply impactful to you, on a day-to-day basis, the way that we tie our shoes doesn't probably deeply impact our worldview or our thoughts. Maybe the few seconds in the morning when we bend down to tie our shoes. I'd be willing to bet that most of us have probably never had a fight with family members or friends or a heated argument about the proper way to tie our shoes. No matter the sect of Mormonism or the level of belief that we hold, for many of us, Mormonism is something that has and probably will continue to impact our thoughts, our actions, and our worldview. Therefore, when we're spending time with friends, family, colleagues, or other acquaintances, our views and lived experiences relating to Mormonism may often come into the conversation. There's a good chance that many of us have had conversations relating to Mormonism or topics heavily influenced by Mormonism where we didn't see eye to eye with our conversation partner. These relationships can be difficult to navigate because of the deep and meaningful nature of one another's faith and belief. Oftentimes, we may have similar lived experiences to those around us. Some common examples might include learning to drive a car, getting married, or having children. And sometimes we have extremely similar lived experiences, such as getting married around the same time or in the same building. Maybe we have children that are the same age or have similar interests. Maybe by some weird chance we have, went to the same school and had the same driver's ed instructor. For most matters, though, it is easy for us to respect that no matter the amount of similarities, our lived experiences are unique to us as an individual and won't look, feel, or be the same for everyone. When we discuss our lived experiences related to faith and belief, it can be more difficult to respect the lived experiences of others as being unique. During my Mormon faith crisis, I spent a great deal of time deconstructing the spiritual experiences that I had related to uniquely Mormon ideas. As a teenager, I had what I would describe as a spiritual confirmation of the truthfulness of the contents of the Book of Mormon. During my faith crisis, I came to attribute the spiritual confirmation I received to several psychological and sociological principles, including confirmation bias. I still have friends and family members that at various times in their lives have experienced what they would describe as spiritual experiences or spiritual witnesses of the truthfulness of the Book of Mormon. It would be easy for me to explain the spiritual witnesses of the Book of Mormon for each of my friends and family in the same way that I've explained mine. But unfortunately, I'd be making a mistake by assuming that just because the lived experience that I had in relation to the Book of Mormon sounds similar to the lived experiences of my friends and family members, that it is indeed the same. We must remember that our lived experiences are unique to us. To provide an example from an alternate point of view, it would be unwise for an Orthodox believing member of a faith tradition to assume when a friend or family member decides to disassociate themselves or distance themselves from that particular faith tradition, that the disassociated member will not have as happy or healthy of a life had they stayed. The Orthodox believing member in this scenario is making assumptions based on their own lived experiences and not taking into account the individuality and uniqueness of their friend or family member's experiences. Instead of dismissing or explaining the lived experiences of those who share different levels of faith and belief from us, we are better off seeking to understand and appreciate the lived experiences that are unique to each person. While we cannot control our friends and family members' actions or thoughts, we can model the behaviors that we would like to see from them and do our part to better our relationships. We need to do less explaining, arguing, and lecturing, and more listening, empathizing, and loving. Oftentimes, when we seek to listen without the intent of providing feedback, advice, or counterarguments, we understand each other better and our relationships deepen. In his recent book, Bridges, Ministering to Those Who Question, author David Osler describes that instead of trying to dismiss, explain, or advise on each other's faith and belief, that we ought to seek to build a bridge of understanding. David mentions, when engineers design a bridge, they study the geology and subsurface conditions of the area. They design a foundation, select the building materials, and create the supports that will bear the load between the two sides, closed quote. Likewise, when we seek to build bridges across faith and belief, we must take the time to understand the factors influencing the beliefs of those we associate with, allow both parties, including ourselves, to feel comfortable and empowered in our lived experiences and beliefs, create support systems for each other that bear the load of our differences evenly, and finally, build a bridge of love and understanding. Thank you, everyone, for allowing me to share those thoughts with you today, and I look forward to your questions later. Let's see here. I'll turn the time over to Nick. I think he's got some thoughts to share.
Thanks, Riley. Hi, everyone. My name is Nick Stewart. I'm gonna crib a little bit from Lindsay Hanson Park on your polygamy, and I'm gonna start by giving my Mormon cred. I was essentially born and raised in the church. I did all the, you know, I hit all the normal benchmarks. I got baptized when I was 8. I got the priesthood when I was 12. Although both of those I pushed back on a little bit, which we might talk about later. Things were more or less okay. Then somewhere in high school, I kind of went inactive. Came back to church in my early mid-20s. So I avoided a mission. And from there on out for a while, it looked pretty normal again, right? So got married in the temple. I served in 4 elders quorum presidencies. Turned down a couple of callings because I like to say no to things. And then at some point I just kind of decided that the church wasn't really working for me, and that it never really had worked that well for me, which is kind of why I stopped attending when I was a teenager. And so I just kind of stepped away from the church. That was a couple of years ago now, since that I don't think I've been to a Mormon church service in five years now, maybe, four, maybe. That's my Mormon background. And so to a certain extent, you know, I certainly hit some of the, you know, sort of traditional, benchmarks, you know, mission excluded, but, I wasn't really a traditional Mormon in reality. Right. So, I am adopted. I'm biracial. My adoptive parents, who I just call my parents because they are, my mother is white, my father is African-American, they're both converts, but I was a blackish kid in the LDS Church in Southern California in a small beach town. So things were not necessarily super traditional Mormon for me in that regard. You know, I had a lot of challenges with people in church, you know, like my age peers when I was a kid for a variety of reasons, some of them my own. I'm just kind of a pain in the butt sometimes. Typical, you know, ADHD kid, you know, just kind of all over the place all the time. But I also just wasn't that into the same things as far as the church went, right? So I went to church because it's what my family did. I didn't necessarily go to church because I loved it. I didn't really care a whole lot about reading my scriptures and all the church stuff. I liked spending time with other people at church sometimes, more so as an adult than as a kid. But, you know, the geography of where I lived as a kid mattered a lot in kind of how I got along with members of my ward, because when I was a younger kid, up until about the age of 9, we lived far away from the more from the majority of the people in the ward. When I was a little bit older, we moved into town, so to speak, and we were closer, but we still lived at the edge of town. At my elementary school, there were only a couple of other Mormon kids. So I never really connected a lot with them. As a result, I kind of always surrounded myself with non-Mormon people. Not necessarily a choice, consciously, right? But this is kind of how it happened. As a result, I feel like I've always kind of walked that sort of line between being Mormon, being, you know, very much in and sometimes of the world, as the phrase goes. But I've kind of always done that bridging between the two, right? Like, spend, you know, during the week I'm with my friends, I'm being very not Mormon. Sundays I go to church. Sundays I see, you know, my people at church and whatever. Next day, Monday, with the exception of seminary, you know, I'm back at school and it's like I'm not really Mormon anymore. Being Mormon for me was very compartmentalized, right? I've been Mormon when I go to church, when I'm at a church thing, when I'm not at a church thing, I'm just me. And so I think that because I've kind of always compartmentalized that, it makes this a lot easier for me, or it has made it much easier for me now, still continuing to interact with people who are active believing Mormons, and, you know, with me not being one. I think that, you know, again, going back to my family structure, my mother joined the church when she was a teenager, and she's still active and as far as I know, believing. I think, Mom, you're watching this. Feel free to chime in the Q&A if you're not. We can have that conversation. My dad joined the church. You know, he's an African-American man who joined the church when the church did not see fit for African-American men to hold the priesthood. So I grew up with that. Like, I was born in 1980, so by the time I was born, black men could have the priesthood in the church. But I grew up knowing that that was a thing that had not been allowed. So, you know, that caused me to have questions and thoughts, and I think it probably... I feel pretty confident that it probably colored, so to speak, my dad's view of the church. And so I grew up in a house where, you know, we were not overly Mormon at home. I've grown up watching my parents, you know, have conversations where the church is part of the subject, and I've seen how they handle it, being at different levels of belief themselves. And so, you know, I think it's been much easier for me in that context to be able to kind of, you know, moving forward, have those conversations with people who don't, with whom I don't necessarily share religious values or beliefs with. I think this topic is important because I have seen so much as I was I don't necessarily call my own journey away from the church a transition, because I feel like I was kind of already there. I just had to figure out that that's where I was and that it was okay for me to leave. But, you know, as I was kind of journeying out of the church, and then once I left and just being active in social media groups and interacting with a lot of other people who, folks who use the label ex-Mormon, which I don't normally use for myself, just hearing all these stories about how they, because they no longer believe and because they stopped attending church, how friends, family, spouses in some case, just like it ruined their relationships. And to me, that boggles my mind. I can think of a couple of people who I don't really talk to anymore because I'm not Mormon, but those people I don't think were ever really that close to me in reality, right? Like, there were people I knew in the ward. I'd see them at church. We could talk, but we weren't necessarily friends. I've been fortunate that I haven't experienced that myself, but I think part of it is because of where I kind of feel that I sit in the sort of belief level, right? Like, I'm not antagonistic about the church. I know there's a certain stereotype about, you know, angry ex-Mormons, and, you know, I fully understand why people go through an angry stage when they're leaving the church. I get it. It's not something that I necessarily felt. I never really expressed as much outwardly, because, again, I feel like I never necessarily believed that much, so I don't feel like I had a lot to be angry about. But I definitely understand it, and unfortunately, that often leads to some of the problems, in these relationships. Both sides of the of this equation, both the active believers and those that, you know, that no longer believe, or those who leave, kind of have a role to play in sort of how these relationships stop functioning well. Mormons are very insular, for better or worse. And there's a lot of defensiveness that kind of comes with that. And at the same time, when someone that you love suddenly changes, particularly like the one thing that you guys felt you always were going to have in common, I understand why Mormons can feel hurt and how that can, you know, kind of manifest in you know, damaged or ruined relationships. The folks who leave the church were Mormon, and the missionary mindset is real. Mormons are a really good job of teaching you, if you know the truth, share the truth, tell everyone you know. The drawback is that backfires on the church sometimes when people find out, new information, and they start sharing that with all the Mormons they know, which, again, can, you know, is part of that whole, you know, damaging relationships thing. It's unfortunately too often both sides see the source of the issue as being the person on the other end of it. And I think that it's tough when you're in the middle of it to take the step back and kind of realize your own role in damaging a relationship. That being said, that certainly is not the case for everybody, right? Not every relationship that ends up damaged because someone transitions out of the church or stops believing, or because someone joins the church and, you know, now they've left their, you know, other community behind. Those aren't all necessarily simply because both people contributing. It certainly can be one-sided. But I think that one of the things that really helps is being able to just kind of realize that, especially if you are someone who has left the church, that, you know, you likely were very much like the person who you're now having this problem with, right? Many Mormons react the same way when a loved one experiences doubt or leaves the church. It's understandable. I don't think that that makes it okay. Like, I don't think it's okay that relationships end because someone leaves a church, but I certainly think that it's understandable. And I think it's important that we all can try to take that step back and just kind of look and see, like, why are they reacting this way? You know, for me, as I said earlier, I was kind of viewed myself as me, and the fact that I was Mormon was like one aspect of me. It wasn't who I was all the time. It didn't create like the baseline of like who I am as a person. And that's not the case for everybody. But I think that if you can, you know, whether you're the active believer or, you know, you're someone who's left the church, if you can, you know, start seeing things as, you know, whether or not the other person is still Mormon, their Mormonness is not the only aspect of who they are. You know, it's very likely that your relationship with them coalesced because you knew them as a Mormon and you were a Mormon as well. But that likely is not the only thing that you guys had in common. I think being able to try to find the things to focus on that you have in common still, the things that haven't changed, you know, if you guys used to hang out and, you know, go bowling, still go bowling, right? That's totally cool. Like, you can still do those sorts of things. They don't have to be tied to the church. And that obviously is more difficult for some folks than others for a variety of reasons. But, you know, I think that it's just important to be able to just still have those conversations. And I think that if you've left the church, one of the easiest things to do, to try to keep those things, you know, to keep those conversations happening and to try to keep those relationships, you know, functional, is just to let the other person know that, you know, I've changed my beliefs about this thing, but I don't necessarily think that you need to, right? Like, I think a lot of the concern that Mormons have is fear. I think a lot of time Mormons are concerned. Part of it is certainly, you know, like, oh no, so-and-so has fallen away. They want to sin. They're going to be evil now. All the rhetoric, essentially. But I also think that there's a fear of what that means to them. Is this person going to try to convince me to leave the church? Is this person going to try to, you know, share lies with me And the answer is, in many cases, unfortunately, yes. People leave the church and then try to convince people to also, you know, see the truth and leave. That's certainly a tactic people take. It's not one that I personally, you know, ascribe to, but everyone's different. I think that letting people know, I have made this decision for myself. This is who I am. I'm totally cool with us still being friends. I would totally still like to hang out with you. I would still love to, you know, go out and get dinner every week or whatever it is that was like your guys' thing. But you need to understand that I'm not believing anymore. And I'm cool with us still being friends if you're still cool with that, knowing that. Let them know, like, I don't intend to try to change you. Like, I still think we can be friends with me being an ex-Mormon and you being a Mormon. Like, that's fine by me, right? It's tough. But I don't think it's impossible. Obviously, everything depends on the people involved, and certain people are tougher nuts to crack, I guess is the phrase. And certainly it matters a lot on where you are. You know, if you have the benefit of not being in Utah or Arizona or Idaho or Alberta, the Mormon suspender, as I call it, you probably have an easier time of doing that because you are not forced to do that with everyone you know. You know, if you live in a place where it's not a Mormon majority already, you probably already have a lot of experience talking to, you know, like as you know, like when you were a Mormon, talking and interacting with people who are not. And you probably have a lot of friends that are not Mormon. So when you leave the church, you are less likely to ruin those relationships, right? But yeah, I think that's kind of what I'll say for now. And I look forward to answering questions that might come up. For now, I will turn the time over to Angelica.
All right. Thank you. It was great to hear from Riley and Nick. I definitely resonated with a lot of what they were saying. So like for me personally, I guess, as Nicholas said, I'll give my Mormon cred. So I'm actually a convert to the church. I converted when I was 19. I went to BYU Idaho as a non-member. So yeah, everybody always asks me why did you go to BYU as a non-member? Blah, blah. It's kind of another story, but, I have been in the church for about 12 years now. Because I was 19. So yeah, that makes sense. And I kind of have a very sort of traditional journey. Like after you're a convert, you know, you get baptized. I got married in the temple, et cetera. I have three kids. I'm still married, same guy that I married in the temple. And we kind of just made our little Mormon family, you know? I think it was, you know, it was kind of after I became a mom and when I was kind of being this very traditional kind of LDS woman. And it was something that, you know, that was kind of the image that was put up is like, this is, you know, the poster child, this is who you are going to be. And that was what I did. There were no other really examples in my life of that. I am the only member in my family. My mom was also a stay-at-home mom. She did it because she wanted to. Like she even says now, she works now, but she just, because all her kids are grown up now. She's just very much kind of that home body type of person. I kind of, you know, followed in the footsteps of other people, like throughout kind of my whole 20s. And I experienced a lot of depression, anxiety, and it's, you know, some of it I think was, you know, due to that living in that way, this kind of prescribed way that we really set out for women. So, kind of breaking out of that, I've been breaking out of that kind of for the last few years now. My youngest child is 3, oldest is 9. So I've had a little bit more time to deal with that, but also have started making more conscious choices about, you know, rather than just defaulting to the sexist norm of how some people choose to live their life, rather than just defaulting to that, actually choosing, you know, what I want to do. And that I maybe don't want my whole identity to be my kids. or my whole identity to be my family. In Mormonism, that's typically not something that you hear women say. It's not something that is really okay for women to say. I mean, you know, you stand up and say that in relief society. That kind of was sort of the foundation of my transition, so to speak. I don't even know. Why do we say that word, transition? I still consider myself active believing. I just am active believing in a different way. I really appreciate this time to talk about, the relationships we have with people and how, we navigate those relationships with folks who are different than us. I think the one thing in Mormonism, I think probably the biggest pitfall, and it comes in our communication, is when we have, we need to think about the goal of our communication when we're talking or relating to other people who are different than us. And I think a lot of times our goal in mind is to either convince somebody of the validity of our experience, or to convince somebody out of the validity of their own experience. A lot of times we have this idea of, you know, we must all conform to this certain idea of Mormonism. We're all Mormon, so we all must believe this same thing. It can't be different for anyone else. And the culture of conformity, really, I mean, it's very prevalent for sure. And it's kind of, I think, what really trips up our relationships is that we don't allow for the fact that, okay, not everybody conforms to the same idea that I conform to. Not everybody defines Mormonism in the same way that I define it. And sometimes I think that we don't see that. We can go a long time, we can go years without, you know, seeing other people for who they really are. And yeah, we definitely can play into the culture of conformity. And I think a lot of us that, I'm sure some folks that have maybe totally transitioned outside of the church very much understand the culture of conformity and pushing against that, I'm sure. But even still staying in the church and choosing to stay, like I have chosen to stay, I mean, it's kind of a daily battle. So there's a few thoughts that I had about that and how communicating across the very real and supposed divides in our faith and belief. We want to create belonging without enforcing conformity. And that's definitely a difficult thing to achieve. However, there's a few basic boundaries, I suppose. You could call that some basic rules for communicating across those divides that we have. And the very first rule is that, and we've kind of, Riley and Nicholas have touched on it a little bit, is that everybody has the right to their own interpretation of Mormonism and their own faith and belief. We even have the idea in Mormonism, and has been talked about by people who, leaders and prophets, so to speak, that, you know, our religion is our personal walk with God. And it's nobody else's, it's ours. And so owning that is part of that. And so when we own that, we also have to let other people own that too. It's very kind of easy to see this in a very sort of personal way and not understand that the same rules apply to everybody else as apply to me. And so therefore I have to respect the fact that other people have their own personal journey too, and that it doesn't look like mine. Sometimes that can be a little bit like, oh yeah, right, of course. And the second rule, this comes from Brené Brown. She says to always assume that people are doing the very best that they can. Always assume good intent. And I mean, that's definitely something that will always, you know, serve you well. There are very few people in the world who are actually malintended. And so always assuming that goodwill is something that, you know, really helps build that bridge. And then I talk about, you know, using active listening skills, you know, reflecting what you hear back, being more concerned about understanding rather than about, you know, convincing somebody else. I've sort of adopted this idea that I'm not there to convince anybody of my validity. Like, that's not my job. Whether they are convinced of my validity is their issue. It's not mine. And I'm definitely not there to, convince anybody out of their validity, of course. having that boundary, having that understanding. And so oftentimes when people feel misunderstood, they start becoming combative. And so a lot of times if we simply, validate how the person is feeling, create understanding about their experience. I understand how that could feel like that way to you. Then a lot of those defenses start coming down. We start being able to, Brené Brown talks about taking off our armor. Anyways, if you don't know Brené Brown, get into some Brené Brown. I definitely talk about her a lot. So the fourth kind of little rule that I've come up with is to prize the relationship over opinions and ideas. And this is, something that's really important, and it creates that safety and that kind of pulls in the power of belonging. It's that we are, our relationship is the most important thing here. And therefore I'm going to prize the relationship over, convincing you of this or you convincing me of that, and we are going to, have this relationship out of goodwill. One of Melissa Inouye, she talks about the way of openness by Randall Paul. Conventions. This was when she gave a presentation at Mormon Women for Ethical Government in April 2020. She says, Randall has taught me that prior to any dialogue on a controversial topic or question, you must first build a relationship between the interlocutors, preferably over food, lasting over an hour and a half. In this first meeting, the dialogue topic is off the table. The only question the two have to answer, taking equal time, is, how did you come to your deepest beliefs? This begins to build a relationship and establish trust. So, she talks about this was, how people construct large dialogues about dealing with these differences in faith. But we can definitely take it, to our own very personal relationships. This becomes about the relationship and not about our disagreements, not about our differences, but this becomes a time for sharing who we are and for accepting each other for who we are. So my fifth rule is self-examination, to examine your own insecurities and triggers. Why do you feel a certain way when so-and-so says this? Why did that bother you? What trauma resurfaced? Name the feeling. What deeply held idea was challenged? Being able to self-examine your own feelings and understand, having that emotional intelligence is something that will definitely serve you in your relationships. And because if you do not understand, how you're feeling or where this is all coming from, it will be very difficult to, traverse these relationships. It definitely makes it a lot easier when you know what your triggers are and what about it when somebody says this that just grinds your gears, And so in examining those triggers and working on those, is going to serve you well in that, I think, and it has me for sure. I think that was kind of all I have. Just to reiterate, the most important thing is that our goal in these conversations with the folks around us is to create belonging without enforcing conformity and enforcing our idea of conformity. I've kind of come away, I call it, do you preach the gospel of conformity or do you preach the gospel of openness and love? And that's kind of the way I think about it is, yeah, we're not there to create conformity. We are here to create a church and a community of belonging. And so that's kind of what I hope to, you know, that's kind of my goal and my mission when I'm communicating with those who are of the same belief as me, but also of very differing, is that, you know, we still belong. And, you know, we have to hold that space for each other. That's part of, I feel like that's part of the gospel itself, part of the teachings of Jesus Christ. And it's definitely, you know, a greater and more excellent way than just holding people to these certain ideas and standards that, you know, maybe one of these, some of us have. So anyways, thanks for listening to that spiel, and I will. I think we're going to turn the time over for questions, and so hopefully there will be some good discussion and some questions about, you know, your specific, relationships and you know, issues that you've come across in your relationships with friends or non-friends or ward members, etc. I'm excited to talk about that. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. We do have about 15 minutes or so for questions, and we have a question here from Allison Mercer, and she asked, "What can we do when only one party is willing to be respectful and listen?" And Riley, you want to take that first?
Sure. I'll just say a few things, and then if Angelic or Nick has anything else to add, that'd be great. So this is definitely, I think, something common for a lot of people, no matter what your level of belief is that you're making your best effort and you're not really getting it reciprocated, right? So I think the first thing that I would say is that we can try and model the behavior that we wish to see from our conversation partners. So, That a lot of times can go a long way. So if you're a friend or family member, if you approach them and want to talk about something that's a difficult or controversial topic or something that kind of brings emotions up, and their response is kind of just to preach their ideology to you, one of the things that we can do is we can just, what would we want them to do to us? And so let's, in that scenario, I would take the time to just say, as Angelica was describing, let's question how do they come to their beliefs? What influences their beliefs? What things are important to them? Let's ask questions and see if we can model the behavior that we would like to see back from our conversation partner. And then I'd also say that there are times when even we try that and it just doesn't work. And in those scenarios, sometimes it might be beneficial for you to set a boundary, which is a perfectly healthy thing for you to do. So if you've tried lots of different things, you've tried to be respectful and try to, you know, then maybe you just come to a conclusion that you say, you know what, hey, like Angelica was talking about, I value our relationship more than anything else. And so I want to keep our relationship solid and be able to share common experiences and get along and love each other. And so, you know what, I think it would be more comfortable for both of us if we just didn't talk about that sort of topic, or, you know, together, because it doesn't seem like it's something that we're able to, you know, it brings up emotions for me that are difficult to deal with or something like that. It's okay for us to set a boundary if things aren't going well. So Angelica or Nick, if you have anything else to add, go ahead. I'd appreciate it.
So I mean, I would definitely echo everything Riley said, is that as much as we can set the example for these conversations, which is, and kind of set the standard for, you know, having a respectful conversation. I mean, not everybody's going to just jump onto that, and everybody is, you know, kind of in their own place. And some people are in a place where it's difficult for them to accept, you know, your differences, you know, in your faith now. And so, you know, Brené Brown also talks about how not everybody, you know, deserves your vulnerability and your story. Not everybody's ready to hear all of that. And so, I mean, having good boundaries is part of this too. And it's, I mean, it's totally okay to say, hey, you know, we're going to take this off the table. One thing, I don't know if you've ever listened to Dr. Hanks. She is Julie Diaz-Avedo Hanks. She talks about, you know, setting these boundaries, and she's a really good source for that. Anyways, if you have any other, like, very specific background or anything on that question, that's fine. Like who this, you know, who the relationship is, a little more details too would be more helpful. But yeah, go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, it's tricky, right? Like, it's always going to be tricky. There are going to be people who aren't receptive. That doesn't mean you shouldn't try necessarily, right? But you also should not necessarily try to force it. You can only do so much. The onus should not be on only one person to make the relationship work. That's like that's just the reality. Relationships are not one-way streets, or at least healthy relationships aren't. You know, I personally think it's perfectly valid to, you know, to tell someone, like, I understand that you right now are not in a place where this is going to work out. I'm here when you're ready, and make it known. You know, I think that there are certainly going to be cases where someone might reach back out later and say, you know, I'm sorry, I was blunt, like, whatever. They'll, you know, they will have whatever reason, whether it's valid or not, doesn't matter, right? Like, if you're, like, the, you know, like, if your concern is the relationship, it doesn't matter if their reason is something they're making up or it's valid, you know, like, it's true. But someone might reach back out and say, you know what, I'm sorry, you know, like, I want us to be friends. But sometimes that won't happen. I think it's important to know, like, it's important sometimes to make the decision, like, is this relationship important enough to me to try to make it work? I've seen people try to maintain relationships that probably aren't worth the effort in the long run. And again, like, it's tough because you have to be able to make that decision, and, you know, it's not always easy. It is unfortunate when people lose themselves in a relationship, and it's also unfortunate when people lose themselves while trying to maintain the relationship, right? So I just think it's tough, and every situation is different. I mean, I think it's different if you're talking about a marriage versus a friend that you hang out with sometimes. The impact level of these relationships are just different, right? Like, a life partner versus, you know, that person at work who you might be able to avoid, maybe it's going to be okay. I think that the wrong thing to do in those situations is just to, like, is to completely write the person off as they're never going to listen. That's completely over. I think you need to be open to the fact that the relationship might not work, but I don't think it's necessarily safe to just write it off completely. Because again, the person could come around. But I also think that, you know, even the phrasing of this question, I'm just curious about how the individual parties in, you know, like, in these relationships view the idea of respectful. 'Cause I think a lot of the times, active believing Mormons, an ex-Mormon might reach out to them and try. The Mormon sees anything that the ex-Mormon does that tries to talk about the church in any shape as not being okay, and will kind of shut them down. And that can be seen as them, as the Mormon not being respectful. And the opposite also happens, right? Ex-Mormons are like, often it's a boundary setting thing. A lot of ex-Mormons are like, I just don't want to talk about the church with you. But a lot of Mormons just like talking about the church. And if they do that, it's going to annoy the ex-Mormon. So they might get, you know, like, they might bristle. So it's going to be seen as them not being respectful. So I think it also helps to maybe, at least at the beginning, explain to the other person, like, I really don't appreciate this conversation. It's not that I don't respect your beliefs. It's just that for me, this is like it's a boundary thing. If those things have been explained, and, like, the, you know, like, what respectful means, you know, like, in those contexts has been explained and defined, at that point, then it's a, I understand we're not going to get there right now. Come to me when you're ready. And just kind of stop forcing it.
Okay, we have another question from Brian Poole. My family has such strong stigma about anything the church considers, quote, anti-Mormon, which makes it hard to honestly answer their questions. Do you have any suggestions for approaching this in a non-threatening way? And I'll open that up to any of the three of you.
Sure. I'll go ahead and at least add some thoughts. So, I mean, obviously there's some context that probably would be better to have on this question. And so, Brian, if you feel like you want to add context to kind of like how these conversations start or go, that's great if you want to add that in there. But in terms of my guess, I'm just making some assumptions here that, Brian, you're at a point where, you take at least a non-orthodox believing approach to Mormonism, or you're, completely non-believing. I don't know. But I think when we have these conversations, should our believing, friends and family members bring them up, it is important. I mean, there's this idea. I don't know that it's necessarily super valid, but this anti-Mormon, literature or facts that exist. And it can be difficult to navigate that space. And so I would say if you have the ability, you can just tell somebody, what would you like to talk about? You can kind of let your friends and family members set the boundaries. So let's just say, your friends, because it sounds like they've got questions for you. And so if they ask questions of you, you can say, well, what would you like to know? Is there something historically that you'd like to talk about? Do you want to talk about polygamy? Do you want to talk about, the first vision? Do you want to talk about scriptures? What do you want to talk about? And then I do think that kind of introducing them to what they would consider safe sources is a great way to start. I recently had a friend that asked me, what triggered my faith crisis, or what has led me to have a non-orthodox belief of Mormonism. And obviously for me, I'm not going to probably share with him. I mean, I think the common thing for people to do is like just share the CES letter with people, which is not usually very helpful. I don't know how familiar you are with the backfire effect, but when you introduce a belief that's so deeply opposed to the belief that somebody's heard their whole life, they will actually double down and dig their heels in and become more entrenched in their own beliefs. So it's important, if you want to build bridges and common understanding, that you maybe go to a source that would be comfortable for them. So for me, when my friend asked me, I said, here's these gospel topic essays that the church put out. And I pointed out to him a couple of them that were more troubling for me, and I said, there are footnotes in these essays that were troubling for me when I read the footnotes. And that way you are not sharing something that's not a comfortable source to your friends and family members. So hopefully that's helpful.
Yeah, I think that it really does depend on the specific topic, but the gospel topics essays, everything cited in that is church source. If people have questions and you want to direct them to a thing, at the same time, personally, I just don't talk about much Mormon stuff in general. I've made it pretty clear to people in my life that are Mormon, I'm happy to talk about Mormon things if you'd like, but I have my views, and that's what I'm going to be, coming to the conversation with. My mom is still active in believing. I feel like we can still talk about church things in a decent way. You know, my wife was still active for some time after I stopped attending. You know, we managed as well. I think it depends on the people. I mean, again, I think there's often a problem of folks trying to, you know, trying to kind of hit the Mormons in their life with all the information and trying to send them, you know, like the CES letter thing, you know, or try to hit them with these, you know, hard hitting factual sources. And I put factual in air quotes because to some people, these things are air quote facts and not facts. You know, it's just that rarely works. You know, and it's tough. If you have family and friends that are asking about, you know, the issues, I personally don't think there's anything wrong with saying, I don't really feel like we can have a good conversation about that. Like I think a really good response and a totally valid one is, I care enough about our relationship for us to not have that conversation because I know that we will not be able to have a good conversation about it and leave on good terms. I do that about politics all the time. I mean, religion and politics are very similar in the same regard as like the amount of fanaticism that occurs and how deeply entrenched people get and how strongly they feel about them. I have nothing wrong with telling, I have friends that are very conservative that I'm very good friends with. We are diametrically opposed in politics. We don't generally engage on politics. And when we do, it's with an understanding that we're not trying to convince the other person. Often we're having the conversation for the sake of having a spirited debate, but we're not actually trying to convince the other person. I'm not trying to hurt his feelings. He's not trying to hurt mine. I'm not trying to make him a raging liberal. He's not trying to make me, you know, a Trump Republican. It's fine. We don't have to agree with each other's voting preferences. So, you know, I think it's perfectly fine to say, you know, the church is not something I feel comfortable talking about you with because I care more about our relationship than having that conversation.
Okay, Nick, thank you so much. Angelica, I apologize. I was going to give you about 30 seconds. We don't have that now. But I encourage anybody that has more questions or wants to keep talking about this to keep it up in the chat room. And I know that these guys and Angelica will love to keep talking with you and sharing. So I'm going to close this out and see you guys in a bit.
Thanks, guys.